Dick Van Dyke used to say he got paid to play. Early on, the comedian turned his tall, lanky presence and a certain clumsiness into physical humor.
One of his best-known bits was tripping over an ottoman in the opening to his classic TV show as he greeted his TV wife, played by Mary Tyler Moore. The live audience howled every time. Now 85, Dick Van Dyke looks back on his lifetime of antics and some periods of struggle in a new memoir. As he tells it, he kind of stumbled into show business as well, which accounts for the title, My Lucky Life in and Out of Show Business.
Well, I had come back from the Air Force and got a job as an announcer. And a friend came and said, you want to go out to California, do an act. Well, I was totally footloose. And I just said, what time you pick me up? And we drove out here and started doing a little act. Just as a lark, we never intended, you know, to have a life in show business. We were going to go back and go to school and do something serious. But one thing led to another. Television came along. Things just came out of the woodwork. It was amazing.
Let's jump ahead to 1959. You're in a hit Broadway show, Bye Bye Birdie.
Yes.
And then Carl Reiner, as you describe him, comedic genius, offers you a TV role that it really changes your life.
Oh, absolutely.
And the show that Carl Reiner was coming up with was called
Head of the Family,
which, of course, nobody listening will recognize. But Head of the Family would soon be known as the Dick Van Dyke Show.
Yes.
And it would be centered on a show business office and the home of Rob Petrie. Who was playing Rob Petrie in the original?
Carl Reiner. Carl had written it for himself. I saw the pilot. He was wrong for it. And he admits that. Carl was played a very nervous, anxiety-ridden father. You know, Rob wasn't that kind of a guy. So we did the pilot, and Carl kind of adapted it to me. He just wrote me the way I am, and was, as he did for the whole cast, and it was just falling off a log. And most of the time, he would find something that happened to one of us and turn it into a script. So they all had a kind of a basis in reality, which I think helped.
We have a clip from one of those episodes. It's the cat burglar episode.
The cat, oh, yeah, which really happened. One night, my wife and I were awakened by what sounded like someone breaking in.
Rob! Somebody's trying to get into our house!
Shh, shh. Anybody's trying to get in. I think somebody's trying to get out.
So I got up and I had a 25 automatic gun that I had kept in a drawer just for those occasions, but it had no ammunition in it. And I said to my wife,
where's the bullet?
It's in my jewelry box.
Which had a little ballerina on top. And when you opened it, it played the Danube Waltz. So I was trying to get the bullets out and at the same time kill the Danube Waltz. And
so you mean every time?
I would open it and grab one bullet and then close it, open it and grab another bullet. Turned out there was no one in the house whatsoever. But I told Carl about it and he wrote the script.
A key feature of the Dick Van Dyke Show was the chemistry between you and Mary Tyler Moore.
Yes.
You're right that people constantly thought you were actually married.
That's true. If I tried to check in a hotel with my real wife, they...
Wait a minute.
Caused me a few problems. Around the second season, we would try to rehearse and begin to giggle and laugh at for no reason. And a psychiatrist said, you have a crush on each other. And she... I realized that's true. We both had a little crush on one another.
It almost feels that you were indeed a little bit in love with her.
Probably. I would say so. We both had this kind of a mutual attraction. In a lot of movies and series that they play that out all the way. But Mary is a very decent young lady, and I wasn't of the type.
Throughout this memoir, these show business legends pop up, little cameos. You don't always even meet them. Lucille Ball in the audience and others. And Frank Sinatra, Cary Grant wandered into your dressing room, scrutinized your wardrobe. But ultimately, you got a call from your hero, a man you mimicked as a kid, really,
yeah.
Stan Laurel.
I called him. He had seen me on television and knew who I was. I was just overjoyed because I had... Well, I said to him on the phone, you know, I've copied a good deal from you over the years. And he said, yes, I know. But he invited me to his home on that Sunday. And I would make regular little visits up there and talk to him. And, of course, just grill him about how he came up with this funny idea and that funny idea. Quite a gentleman.
You tell a funny story in the book how you had invited Stan Laurel for an episode of Dick Van Dyke. And you call, and he couldn't make it to the show, but you watched. You called after to find out what he thought. He did say something. He said, it was the best impersonation I've ever seen,
yes.
Son, to you. That's nice. And then he said, just one more thing.
Well, the brim of the hat was flat, and I had literally taken an iron and tried to flatten out the brim of the hat I had, and it wouldn't do it. But he did comment on that. Oddly enough, after he died, I did the eulogy at his funeral, and he had left me the hat, which had vanished, and it hadn't been seen to this day. I thought I was going to get that hat. I have his bow tie.
Well, that's wonderful. Where do you keep it?
Oh, I have it in a box, and I have a tailor-made pool cue that Buster Keaton left me. So I also used to visit him, too, all my idols.
Dick Van Dyke, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dick Van Dyke's memoir is called My Lucky Life in and Out of Show Business. And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
The Hollywood version of Thor may be smashing his way to box office glory, but the real Thor, the hammer-wielding god of thunder, lightning, storms, destruction, well, he's slightly more complicated.
Thor was the head-smashing Norse god of lightning, thunder, storms, being awesome, and killing giants by hitting them in the face with a meat-normous magical hammer. The son of the god Odin and the goddess Fjorgyn, Thor was the defender of the heavenly land of Asgard, the toughest warrior among the gods, an original Avenger, best friends with Captain America and Iron Man, and the guy who everybody called on whenever they needed some pompous ass kicked out through his forehead.
That's Ben Thompson. He's been writing a blog called Badass of the Week, that's what it's called, since 2004, and he's got a new book out. It's called Badass, Birth of a Legend, and it's a who's who of the baddest dudes in the world of badass. Captain Kirk, Chuck Norris, Samson, Diomedes, Beowulf, King Minos, gods and heroes to monsters and aliens, and most importantly, B.A. Baracus.
I'll pay the fool!
Ben Thompson joins me now from the studios of KUOW in Seattle. Ben, let's get one thing out of the way first. Who is, or what is, a badass? Who qualifies?
So that's one of the difficult questions I came across when I started doing the website and started writing these books, is that, you know, it's kind of this inherent thing where you realize immediately if somebody's a badass or they're not. But then how do you reconcile, on the one hand, a guy like King Leonidas? He's this great hero. He's holding the pass of Thermopylae against the Persians. He's, you know, a hero to his people. And on the other hand, you've got a guy like Genghis Khan, who's conquered, you know, two-thirds of the known world.
Raped and
just
and
massacres.
Pillaged, yeah.
Yeah, totally. Rape, pillage, destruction, you know, giant piles of skulls. So what unites these two characters? So what I came up with was, I think it's determination above all else, right? So it doesn't matter what you're trying to accomplish. It doesn't matter if you're criminally insane or you're trying to save the world or you're trying to conquer everything that's before you. As long as you just go all out for it and you don't let anything get in your way, that's badass.
Mm. So you could say the Navy SEAL who killed Osama bin Laden qualifies, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That whole SEAL Team 6, you know, they're just, you know, they get a job and they do it.
But Justin Bieber, no.
Justin Bieber, probably no, I would say.
Here's
he could go out and get a recording contract, but...
not right.
It doesn't really work.
Here's a tough one. What about Jesus?
You know, Jesus is pretty hardcore in the Book of Revelations. I talk about that a little bit in the new book. According to John, he, you know, when the second coming happens, he's going to come down from heaven in white robes soaked with blood, a bunch of angel warriors with him. He shoots knives out of his mouth. He takes Satan and he body slams him into like a giant lake of fire. I mean, and he rides off, and then there's just like birds eating corpses. And it's like, that's like, you know, that's pretty hardcore.
That's,
I mean, you
harsh.
Can say what you want.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can say what you want about turn the other cheek and all that stuff, but that's a very hardcore way of dealing with Satan.
What about people in public radio?
Anyone public radio, of course, definitely. You know, if you're going to broadcast my story to, you know, 15 million viewers a second, I'm definitely going to be on board with you being a badass.
All right, okay. I want to go back to Thor because you read that passage from him, from your book about him, and here's who he is. Let me just play a clip of who he is.
Let thy warriors gather. The god of thunder shall save Hercules.
The die is cast.
Why does Thor qualify?
So Thor, you know, what I wanted to do with the piece on Thor in the book is to not necessarily talk about the Marvel Comics Thor. You know, everybody has, you picture him as the Avengers fighting with Iron Man and Captain America, all these things. What I wanted to do was to talk about the Viking myths, the Norse myths of Thor. And Thor in these is like really, really tough. You know, there's one time these giants were pissing off the gods, so he disguises himself as a goddess and goes to some like giant feast that they're having, and then everybody starts to get a little suspicious when he's like eating entire oxes in one bite, and he's drinking like giant barrels of mead, and everybody's like, "What is up with this lady?" And then he throws off his costume and just wastes the entire dining hall with a hammer, you know. And it's pretty awesome, and he, you know. And he's, you know, basically he drinks and he fights, and that's about all he does. The tides, interestingly enough, I'm sorry, I'm rambling about Thor because I'm so pumped up about him, but yeah, the tides were believed to have been caused when a giant magician turned the ocean into mead, and he sucked down half of the ocean.
Oh,
and that's the tides.
It's hard to beat that. You don't have to, of course, be just a good guy to qualify. You've got, in your book, you've got Darth Vader. You've got the criminal mastermind Moriarty from Sherlock Holmes. But Skeletor?
Witless fools, do I have to do everything for you?
All right, Skeletor's a neurotic weirdo, Ben.
Yes.
He does not qualify in my book. He's just a freaky dude.
Skeletor is a giant, beefy-armed bodybuilder with a floating skull head on top of it. And his sole purpose in life is the conquest of Eternia. So this goes back to that determination thing that I was talking about. He gets his ass kicked every 28 minutes by the forces of good, and he's still out there. He pulls out all the stops. Okay, there's a hat that turns you invisible. Awesome, I'm on it. How can I use this to conquer Eternia? He knows, you know, he's the villain in an 80s cartoon. He's going to lose. He's going to end up hanging upside down from a tree with his butt sticking up in the air, everybody laughing at him. But when he has that moment of power, he takes every opportunity to completely berate everybody around him in like the most hilarious ways you can think of.
Don't half-wits, bunglers.
It's kind of a funny chapter in the book, but yeah, I stand by it.
A lot of this book reads as if it might have been written by Jack Black's character from School of Rock, right? but underneath all this stuff, there's some pretty solid information. I mean, it's almost as if there's a secret educational mission going on here.
Totally, totally. And that's the point. You know, I've always been really interested in history. My dad did history in school, and he was kind of this memorabilia collector, and he had some cool old, like, reproduction Spartan swords and some old flintlock muskets and stuff. You know, I never had a chance growing up, because he would, you know, he would tell me, oh, you know, here's the story of Thermopylae, and here's King Leonidas, and he fought, and he had a sword that was like this, and, oh, here's the story of the American Revolution, you know, there's a flintlock rifle like they would have used, blah, blah, blah. And he's telling me all these great stories, and, you know, as a teenage boy, I'm like all over this stuff, like action movie, you know, it's all action movie material.
Yeah.
And, you know, then I went to high school and to college, and I took some of these classes that I thought were going to be really awesome. You know, oh, history of Crusades, yeah, I'm on board. I know World War II in Europe, let's do this. But then I found that there was a lot of literature and a lot of books and a lot of teachers who could take this amazing material and just make it super, super boring. So what I wanted to do was find a way to, you know, I'm not going to say these are definitive histories of these people, but I wanted to find a way of telling the story like a Pulp Fiction novel and to have it be as far away from a history book as I could get without sacrificing the actual history.
The book is called Badass, Birth of a Legend. Ben Thompson is its author. He also writes a blog called Badass of the Week. Ben Thompson, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Facebook was created for college students to get in touch with one another. It has also helped people stay in touch online so well that it might be hurting attendance at real-world class reunions, Alex Schmidt reports.
You know the excruciatingly awkward reunion scene in movies. the dorks and princesses get together to prove that either they've become cool or they're still cool.
So how about you? Any kids?
Like the 1997 film, Romy and Michelle's High School Reunion.
Oh, no, I just haven't had time, you know. I was running my own business and all.
Your own business?
Yeah. I invented Post-its.
These days, you don't have to bother lying about how brilliant you are. Thanks to social networks, everyone already knows. Mark Gervais graduated from Strathaven High School in Philadelphia in 2001. He has no plans to go to his 10-year.
I don't need a reunion.
Why not?
Because I already know what everyone's doing. If I needed to find out, I could just contact them or stalk them through said stalking methods, the unsaid Facebook and Twitter updates.
It seems he's not the only one.
10 years ago, you would have gotten maybe 250 people at a 10-year reunion.
Joanna Erdos is vice president of the Alumni Association of LA's John Marshall High School.
I recently attended a 10-year reunion where there were 94 people. Then there was another one that I didn't get to go to, but I heard the attendance was 43.
Attendance at 10-year reunions is declining across the country, says Great Reunions, one of the nation's largest reunion planning companies. Mike Silva is CEO. He knows more people are staying in touch, so he's changing his marketing pitch from find out what became of Sally to unplug for a night.
There's a lot of people that believe Facebook's good enough, so they don't want to get together.
Well, we try to educate them about, I guess you'd call it, real personal connections.
Actually, Silva points out, Facebook could end up helping with those real personal connections. If you get past the what are you doing question online, you can get on to the more important business of telling people what you really think.
I really thought you guys had it made in high school. And the whole time you were making my life hell. The A group was making your life hell. I didn't know.
You know what? I bet in high school everybody made somebody's life hell.
Reunion planners claim there's no substitute for that face-to-face grown-up connection. Technology comes and goes, they point out, but reality stays. For NPR News, I'm Alex Schmidt. Can you hear them? They talk about us. Telling my ex, well, that was a surprise. Can you see them? See right through them.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Switching gears now to something a lot of us wouldn't mind spending hard-earned money on, the Cannes Film Festival. It's one of the oldest and most prestigious film festivals in the world, a movie marathon combined with much glitz and glamour. Winning the Golden Palm, the festival's highest honor, can turn a small-budget movie into the next box office hit and push an unknown filmmaker to the top of Hollywood's A-list. This year's festival kicked off on Wednesday, so we wanted to hear about the most buzzworthy movies of the event and hear about, you know, the hits, the misses, the surprises. We're joined today by film critic veteran Bruce Kirkland of the Toronto Sun and Sun Media Canada. He's covered the festival for the past 30 years, and he's with us on the phone now from Cannes. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm trying to contain my rage and envy that you are there and I am here. I will try.
If I told you it was hard work, would you believe me?
No. Well, you've got to. Now, you're probably bilingual, as most Canadians are, so you've got to help me out. Is it Cannes or Cannes?
Cannes.
Cannes. And is that how it's pronounced in French?
I believe so.
So it's Cannes.
My bilingualism is rustic, to say the least.
Okay. Well, thanks for clearing that up. So before we get into the different films, can you tell us why winning the Golden Palm is so important? Why is this such a prestigious event?
Excellent question, because the importance of film festivals is a matter of attitude in some cases. Switching gears for a sec, Toronto's film festival has become the preeminent festival in all of North America, and Americans are jealous. But frankly, Toronto doesn't know how that happened, but it has happened. So in the case of Cannes, it has superseded every festival in the world. Venice, Berlin, all of the other traditional European cinema, you know, festivals have tried to usurp the power of Cannes, and they just can't do it. There's a combination of old-school Hollywood, glamour, glitz, a kind of circus atmosphere to it. It's on the French Riviera, so there's a sense of the exotic. And at the same time, they have a remarkable track record in programming their festival with risks as well as, you know, traditional kinds of world cinema.
In one of your recent pieces, you wrote that Europe is dominant, Asia is reasonably represented, the Middle East is being singled out, Africa and South America are mostly absent, Canada is nothing but a flickering shadow, and the United States is once again an uneasy bridesmaid at the world's most prestigious and powerful film fest. Now, is this unusual, or is it usually like this?
Well, actually, it changes every single year. And this is really important to remember because people do get upset. I mean, we Canadians feel like we don't exist this year. And then other years, we might have two films in competition. The United States has had always this kind of strange relationship that with France in general and with the Cannes Film Festival specifically. Without American star power, Cannes is diminished. So when Angelina Jolie shows up today to promote Kung Fu Panda 2, and Brad Pitt's coming for an official competition film, the Terrence Malick film, The Tree of Life, this is really important for Cannes. They need that American star power.
Mm, okay.
At the same time, there's a limited number of major American films in this particular festival.
Well, I just want to talk about a couple of the films in the time that we have left. Woody Allen's Midnight in Paris opened the festival yesterday. I'll just play a short clip.
Where'd Gil run off to?
I've been walking around Paris.
Where do you think Gil goes every night?
He walks and gets ideas.
Mm-hmm. Why are you so dressed up?
I was just doing a little writing.
You dress up and put on cologne to write?
Because you know how I think better in the shower and I get the positive ions going in there.
Well, obviously, that's a trailer. Now, the movie is not in competition, but it's still being shown. Now, can you help us understand that? Like, there's some films in competition, some films are not. How does that work?
It is complicated. Traditionally, the opening night gala is not in competition. And Woody Allen loves to be at Cannes, but not be a competitive piece of art, because he believes that art and entertainment shouldn't be up for prizes. Hence why he's only shown up at the Oscars once, and that was for political reasons and not to collect any Oscars. So he just doesn't like the whole prize mm-hmm. thing. So opening the film festival with such a delightful kind of giddy, romantic comedy, traditional kind of Woody Allen fare, out of competition, perfect for Woody.
I'm speaking with Bruce Kirkland. He's a film critic for the Toronto Sun and Sun Media Canada. We're talking about the Cannes Film Festival, which opened on Wednesday. Let's talk about this documentary that's created a lot of controversy that's officially not apparently a part of the film festival. It's called Unlawful Killing, and it's about the death of Princess Diana. And I'll just play a short clip.
The British establishment think that they have got away with murder, but then what's new? They've been getting away with murder for centuries.
I don't think many people would want me to be queen, actually. When I say many people, I mean the establishment that I'm married into.
Why is this causing such a stir?
Well, none of us has seen it, but excerpts of the film have been put on online. And also, there's been a lot of talk about it starting earlier this week in Britain. And let me explain why it's not part of the official festival. No program invited it. But Cannes has a huge marketplace, the Marché du Film, and they sell films from all over the world. You can actually rent a theater and sell anything as long as it's not hardcore porn. So these people from Britain, Keith Allen is the actor who directed this piece of work. He became obsessed with Princess Diana. He attended the inquest. And he became convinced that she was murdered, and he presented, he's created this film.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, we don't have time to talk about it anymore. And unfortunately, we also don't have time to talk about the other film that's raising some eyebrows. That's Jodie Foster's film, The Beaver, starring Mel Gibson, who's had all kinds of drama in his personal life. So you'll have to come back and tell us about that. Bruce Kirkland is a film critic for the Toronto Sun and Sun Media Canada, and he was with us on the phone from the Cannes Film Festival, where he assures us he's working very hard. Bruce, thank you.
My pleasure.